created a Lord of the Flies dormitory annex. There was a boy in that annex who was mildly annoying. He was a bit arrogant and uptight and had a hometown girlfriend he talked about constantly. He had potted plants in his immaculately neat dorm room. He went his own way most of the time. But somehow the group of boys decided that this mildly annoying boy was not to be tolerated. So the group messed with his belongings, trashed his room, recorded voices over portions of his favorite cassette tapes, and performed other idiocies I can't remember. I was part of that group. Some things I did, some things I helped do, some things I laughed about after they were done. I caused someone else pain. 4 decades later, I'm still ashamed of myself. How on earth could I be part of bullying another boy? But I was. After all, everyone was doing it. Maybe I was afraid that if I didn't go along with this, I'd be the new target. Or maybe it was because I'd spent so many years on the outside of the group that I wanted in. I was one of the guys. Finally, I belonged. I was raised by parents who constantly emphasized the importance of resisting the group. 1,000 times, in many contexts, my mother said, "If everyone is lined up to jump off the George Washington Bridge, are you just going to get in line?" I gave a speech at my high school graduation about the evils of peer pressure. I carried in my wallet from the age of 16 a quotation by Ralph Waldo Emerson. "It is easy in the world to live after the world's opinion. It is easy in solitude to live after our own. But the great man is he who, in the midst of the crowd, keeps with perfect sweetness the independence of solitude." I just typed that without looking it up. Despite all that training, all that reflection, and the face of whatever guilt or hesitation I felt, I surrendered to the loud laughter and the camaraderie of the group, and maybe to a feeling of relief that I wasn't the target. I harassed and bullied another boy, who wasn't very different from me. I was a timid hypocrite and a fool. I was a living example of something I knew then and have come to know even better decades later. We all have a tendency to surrender our moral authority to the group, to still our own voices and assume that the group will handle whatever difficult issue we face. We imagine that the group is making thoughtful decisions, and if the crowd is moving in a certain direction, we follow, as if the group is some moral entity larger than ourselves. In the face of the herd, our tendency is to go quiet and let the group's brain and soul handle things. Of course, the group has no brain or soul separate from each of ours. But by imagining that the group has these centers, we abdicate responsibility, which allows all groups to be hijacked by the loudest voice, the person who knows how brainless groups really are and uses that to his advantage. Had my family stayed in Yonkers, where I was a cool kid, where I was part of a group, I don't know what kind of person I would be now. Being an outsider, being picked on, was very painful, but it made me a better person. It instilled in me a lifelong hatred for bullies and sympathy for their victims. Some of the most satisfying work I did as a prosecutor, in fact, was putting bullies of all kinds in jail, freeing good people from their tyranny. After my experience in college, I was never going to surrender to the group again simply because it was easy. And I was going to make sure my life had some meaning because I'd already seen how fleeting life could be. Chapter 4. Meaning. I have always believed, and I still believe, that whatever good or bad fortune may come our way, we can always give it meaning and transform it into something of value. Hermann Hesse. I have worked with great men over the years, but two of my most important teachers about life and leadership were women. In 1993, after my work on the Gambino trial ended, I kept my promise to Patrice and we moved our family to Richmond, a place where we had few connections but where we could raise a family more cheaply and comfortably. After working briefly at a law firm, I returned to work as an assistant United States attorney, this time in the Virginia State Capitol. The law firm was fine, the pay good, and the people smart, but I missed public service, even with its mismatched furniture and low pay. I couldn't tell my law firm colleagues this, but I ached to be useful again, to do some good for my community and to represent the victims who really needed me. My new boss was Helen Fahey. She was the United States attorney, the supervisor of all federal prosecutors in the eastern half of the state. Fahey's rise to the top was unusual and inspiring. She had stayed home with her young children as they grew, then worked in various roles for a Defense Department agency, starting as a typist. All the while, for 17 years, she pursued her education, as she told the newspaper, one job, one month, one class at a time. She never actually completed a college degree, but was admitted to law school anyway given her high test scores and work history. I was 35 years old when I started working for Helen in 1996. I was the supervisor in the Richmond office, one of four Fahey oversaw, and I had dreams of energizing it to make bigger contributions in all kinds of areas, especially against violent crime and public corruption. Having been an assistant United States attorney in Manhattan and a partner at a big Richmond law firm, I thought I was hot stuff, as my mother used to say, not meaning it as a compliment. Maybe unconsciously picking up on traits exhibited by Rudy Giuliani, I was everywhere in the city and became the face of federal law enforcement in Richmond, representing the office with local law enforcement, the community, and the media. A free weekly Richmond newspaper put a picture of me on its cover, calling me one of the good guys, and identifying me incorrectly as the U.S. attorney instead of an assistant. I had posed for the picture in my office in Richmond. Worse, I hadn't told my boss anything about it. A stunt like that back in Rudy Giuliani's office would have ended very badly. My first reaction to seeing the newspaper with me splashed across the cover was that I would be a dead man unless I seized every copy in the city. Then I remembered who I worked for. Fahey was secure enough to want me to succeed. She laughed at me a bit, which was appropriate and deserved, but she laughed with me more often. Helen Fahey was comfortable in her own skin in a way few leaders are. I think some derided her behind her back as weak. She let Comey take over Richmond, but she knew exactly what she was doing. She was letting me grow, gently smacking me behind the ears every so often to make sure I stayed on track, and getting good results in the process. And she also didn't care much what misinformed people said about her, a lesson I would find very valuable as I grew older. She put the interests of the team and the important job we had to do higher than her own feelings or worries about reputation. Our effort to prosecute gun crimes and reduce Richmond's homicide rate was bitterly resisted by some of the federal judges in Richmond, who saw those kinds of cases as unbefitting a federal courtroom. I didn't care, and my team in Richmond didn't care. We were trying to save lives, so we plowed ahead, infuriating one senior judge. He responded by issuing an order holding